If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, hey, welcome to Page Break. I'm your host, Brian McClellan, coming to you as reservoirs fill with the spring snowmelt here in the mountains of Utah. Today is launch day for me. Montego, my Glass Immortals novella, is officially out. You can pick up signed copies from my website, ebooks from your favorite retailer, and audiobooks from Audible and iTunes. For European readers, you can also get signed copies of all my novellas from The Broken Binding. Also for European readers, don't forget that I'll be at PeerCon in Poznan, Poland for the weekend of June 16th. Now, on with the show. My guest this week is author Becky Chambers. Becky is known for her breakout science fiction Wayfarers series, which began in 2015 with A Long Way to a Small Angry Planet. Wayfarers books have been nominated for a whole bunch of awards and won the Hugo for Best Series in 2019. Becky is also the author of the Monk and Robot series, as well as a number of short stories. Becky and I chat about beekeeping and our love of the natural world, and the way hope and wonder helps fuel our writing. We also talk about the way fiction can explore nuance in a way that the real world often ignores. Finally, we get into the way writers grow and change over time, and how we can fall into the rut of working on the same types of projects for the same types of audiences over and over again. Enjoy my conversation with Becky Chambers. So I saw a thing that said that you are a beekeeper.
I used to be. I unfortunately lost both my hives a few years ago, but I will make this not a bummer, I promise. But yes, I did keep bees for a number of years. Beekeeping is tough in the here and now. And so after my wife and I sadly had to bid farewell to the two colonies under our care, we decided instead to focus on making our yard a good place for native pollinators instead. So I am not as hands-on. I do not have my head in a box of bees on the regular anymore, but I have all sorts of interesting critters doing the same work in my yard. In a way that I don't have to interfere as much with, which I feel good about. So, yeah.
Well, that's great. Mm-hmm. So I actually had the exact same experience with beekeeping. So when I sold my first books mm-hmm. back, I think it was 2012 when I got paid for the first time. And my like big special thing was spending, you know, like $1,000 on beekeep equipment.
Yeah.
You know, I got the nice extractor. I got all the stuff. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it was really fun. And I did it consistently for, I think, about 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then, yeah, the last hive I had was the very beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah.
I got my last hive and it did well that summer. And then it died over the winter. And I finally was just kind of like, oh, okay, I can't deal with getting a new hive every year or two. It's so depressing.
It's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking when it happens. And it is something that just does happen. They're not pets. They're very much their own little ecosystem that you're just trying to be a good steward for. But it is hard. It is hard to lose a hive for sure.
It really is. It's one of those weird things because you can get into it and you don't really understand anything about it until you've done it yourself.
Yeah.
Like you can read all the books and stuff, mm-hmm. but until you're actually like you said, head in the hive, you really don't like understand the little things that you have to deal with. And I don't know, it was very rewarding and very cool. Like I had one of those weird, like awesome things where my very first year I had a single hive and got like 70 pounds of honey from it.
That's insane. That's a crazy amount of honey for a single box. Wow. That's crazy.
I know.
And then I spent the next several years trying to like replicate that and didn't.
Well, because there's no controlling for it, right? Like the bees are going to do what they're going to do. The flowers are going to do what they do. But I think that's actually what it was that I took away from it. Because we actually, coincidentally, so we lost R2 right at the beginning of the pandemic. And I was like, you know what? There's kind of a lot going on in the world right now. I'm not sure that I need to take like 100,000 tiny things under my care right now. I think I'm just going to focus on myself. But that's the thing about it, right? Is that they don't ever get used to you. People talk about like, oh, the bees get used to you. They don't, because they live like 2 months. They have no idea what you are or, you know, what your deal is. You're just this shape that appeared a few times and that's it. What happens is you just get more skilled and more comfortable working with it. But that was one of the things that I found really awe-inspiring about it, was this incredible sense of responsibility, right? This sense of, I have to learn their language. I have to learn what actions are going to upset them, what's going to be comforting for them. I have to learn how to navigate this, even though they cannot reciprocate, you know? And there is something wonderfully humbling, and also very alien about that, right? Like, they don't know what I am or why I'm here, but I have to try and adapt my big clumsy primate body as best as I can to working with these tiny incredible creatures. I've always loved bugs ever since I was little. But my time working with honeybees just gave me such a deeper appreciation for all the tiny things we share the world with. So I'm very grateful for the experience, and I may pick it up again one day. But right now, as I said, I'm happy seeing what moves into my yard without my say so. So that's also very rewarding and fun.
I keep telling Michelle that I'm going to sell all my equipment because it's taking up tons of space in my garage.
Right.
And she keeps kiboshing that. She keeps saying, no, you're going to do it again someday. So you're going to want to at some point. And so just keep everything.
Mm-hmm.
So for the moment, I still have all my stuff. I came out of it with kind of this really really deep respect for kind of this ability, this thing that you don't really have any control over. It. You just you're providing a home, and sometimes you're trying to help with, you know, illnesses or strengthening the hive in some way. But really, you're almost like a landlord.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But like that moment in the late spring, after your hive has kind of grown and gotten itself established for the year, and you first crack it and you pull out like an entire like honeycomb, and you look at it and you're doing your inspection, but you see that first like, you know, capped wax honeycomb, like that moment every year was kind of what I lived for the beekeeping. It's so cool to see this structured, perfectly natural, but very almost human looking, because it's so structured and so well built. I find it really incredible.
Yeah, likewise. They are remarkable engineers, and they're so much better at it than we ever could be. I think they're so sensitive to everything in their environment, and they keep such a tidy house too. Like, it's so clean in there is the other amazing thing. Like, it's so It looks like such a cozy place to be, and they do such a good job cleaning it up. In a lot of ways, I don't want to touch it at all, because I'm just like, you've been doing this for millions of years longer than we've been bothering you about it. So, who am I to interfere? You know,
I liked always taking the extractor after finishing in the fall, take the extractor up and just set it next to the hive, and they clean it up in like 12 hours.
Yeah,
like it's great. I don't know. It's just, beekeeping is one of those things that, like I said, I got kind of depressed with the trying to establish hives and then have a bad winter and they die and but it's still such a cool thing.
Yeah.
I'm always amazed at people that like do it for a living and they have hundreds and hundreds of hives, and oh, that's crazy to me.
Yeah, my wife and I took a beekeeping course before we actually did it, because I'd wanted to try it for years, but you know, I was like, let's actually get some hands, because I didn't want to end up in a situation where I'm like, I bought all this stuff. I have bought literal boxes full of bees and I actually hate this. And that was not what ended up happening. But I was like, I want to learn all I can and try it out first. But yeah, my instructor, so I live in a rural part of Northern California. And so my instructor, we had, you know, a few days of class just at his home, in his bee yard, you know, and I was just like, this is the coolest thing. This is so cool that you just have a bee yard. It's a really beautiful tradition, and there is something also that makes me feel very looking down the long lens of history about it, you know, because people have been beekeeping for thousands of years, and so it is this very, very ancient thing. And I mean, granted, modern beekeeping is very different than when it used to be, you know, let's put some bees in a basket and just throw it in the river, like, to get them out. Like, we have come a long way since that, but still, it's this this very low tech sort of thing. It's a wooden box that you put some things in, and then you just pull honey out of it, and you don't do anything to it. It's just there. I don't know, there's something very sort of old school Homo sapien about it that I also really dig.
Well, and it also was incredibly important historically, mm-hmm. because it was something that didn't take a ton of effort. Like, it didn't take up your harvesting time. Like, you would have to, you know, put a couple of days into it every year. Like, you know, it's hard work and you have to pay attention, but you didn't have to kind of, you know, take away from the other things that you were doing as a hardworking medieval person.
Yeah.
You could keep bees on the side and they would help with your, you know, farm and stuff like that. And the calorie count, just kind of strictly speaking, that you get out of it is kind of amazing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It also made me appreciate wax and candle making so much more. Cause I don't know if you ever harvested the wax as well as the honey. You get so little. Like, you can get a ton of honey, but like the amount of wax you get out of it, like I would render so I didn't use an extractor. I would use just crush and strain, and I would take the wax at the end and, you know, just render it into like a beeswax cake, you know, that you can then melt down and make candles with and stuff. And you get like maybe a pound or two out of, like, two being generous, you know, out of a single hive. And it really makes you appreciate how rare and value, why these things were so valuable, you know, why people were using tallow and whatnot instead, because that was more plentiful and it was cheaper. Whereas like the good stuff that smelled good, you know, that was actually something that was more labor intensive and something that was harder to come by. So it's, I don't know. I love activities like that, that give you an appreciation and an understanding for the things that we really take for granted.
Oh yeah, for sure. Oh, it's really cool. It's such a funny kind of hobby, you know, like, mm-hmm. just, you do learn a lot kind of about just kind of how the ecosystem works. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just the beekeeping itself, but like you said, trying to keep the hive alive, knowing temperatures and knowing, you know, what is required for this crazy little ball of, you know, what, 80,000 bees, mm-hmm. like, how does this exist in this world? Because we don't think about that, you know. Yeah. we're sitting in our houses just doing our thing as humans, and all around us we've got all of that going on, and like you were talking about, just broadly with insects, you know, like, insects are, they're just such a wild, like, thing that, you know, isn't it something like the biomass of insects far outweighs like all of the mammals on the planet or something like that?
It's true. There's way more of them than there are of us. And I want to say that, like, I completely understand people who get squicked out by bugs. I know that I am rare and weird in that they've never bothered me. And so whenever I am, you know, talking to friends about like, oh, I found this cool thing out in the woods. But I always preface it, like, I don't have to show you, like, you have to opt in to me showing you pictures of the weird things I find in the woods. But it is just an incredibly beautiful thing. If they don't spook you, or if you can work up the oomph to just go look at the little stuff, living in your, you know, living in your environment, whether that be rural or urban, whether you're in the country or in the city, like, they're everywhere and they have jobs, and, you know, they're not really interested in us, you know, because they've got their own little lives. They've got their own little dramas. They don't want anything to do with you. They just want to, you know, go find food and find a cozy hole to live in, you know, like, that's very relatable. So, I am constantly fascinated by the communities of things that I live alongside. And I spend a lot of time thinking about what my neighborhood, what my house, what the street looks like to creatures other than us, you know, like big and small. I have a bear that hangs out in behind our house because I'm up against forest. And so I think a lot about what the neighborhood looks like to the bear. And I think about what it looks like to the frogs that also hang out here and the birds and whatnot. You know, like it's fun if you can sit and flip the camera in your head to what does this look like top down? What does this look like if you don't understand a fence? What does this look like if you are, you know, the size of an ant? It's a really good way to to get over yourself and shed a bit of ego, I think, to realize the world is really not all about us.
See, I like to do that. My way of doing that is looking up, you know, like looking at stars at night is like the quickest way to feel your own insignificance.
Yes.
And I actually kind of love it. It's a slightly terrifying feeling, but it's also like really, like it's relieving.
Yes.
You're like, none of this crap that I'm worried about all the time really matters beyond this tiny circle of influence in a human world. Everything else, it's the universe is so much bigger that
it doesn't matter.
You know, even humanity as a species is nothing.
Yeah.
And it's crazy to think about. I bet, like, so does that kind of thinking come into like your science fiction?
Oh, all the time. Like that's the meat and potatoes of it, I think. You know, I grew up looking at bugs. I grew up on Carl Sagan. I grew up going to planetarium shows and whatnot. You know, I've got in my garage right now, I have beekeeping equipment as discussed, but I've also got a couple telescopes out there. You know, like I love looking at the big and small equally and feeling just my extremely insignificant place in the middle of it. And the thing is, I know that again, like bugs, freak some people out. Like there are some people who, you know, and I also understand that too, the existential horror of it all, right? Like, oh God, I don't matter. None of this actually matters. I find it liberating. I find it so comforting and soothing to know like, oh, we're just animals. We're just these animals. I am this momentary collection of, you know, molecules and electrical impulses, and no one knows why, because everybody is, you know, everybody who has ever been able to reflect on the world has been in that exact same state. And I have just this little bit of time. And yeah, sure, mortality, a little freaky. Like that's a little, you know, but that too, I'm just kind of like, okay, for this brief moment, the universe has me in it and it does not revolve around me. I'm one of many, 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 not just people, but different critters, you know? And so to me, that just says, make the most of it, you know? And that doesn't mean you have to like, achieve big things. That doesn't mean you have to, you know, go down in history, whatever. It's not a competition. It's just like, for this instant, this collection of stuff can look at the world and think it's wonderful and can experience things and can keep bees, eat ice cream, have friends, like all these wonderful things, you know. It's that is something that very much fuels what I write and why I write it, because I think that existence alone is worth telling a story about. I tend to tell stories about very ordinary people, very everyday people, and that's on purpose, because what I'm trying to say with that is, you know, look at this big, incredible universe we live in. And it's enough to just exist in it for whatever amount of time that you have. And it does, you don't have to be someone extraordinary. You don't have to be a chosen one or a hero of any kind. It's okay to just be. And those stories are worth telling too. So everything I write is very much an expression of that extremely core piece of my worldview that, you know, that the minutia is beautiful.
Yeah.
Hey, Page Break listeners, Brian here, rudely interrupting myself for a bit of a plug. Making a podcast isn't free, and I'm hoping that you enjoy it enough to pitch in a pittance. To do so, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak, where you can toss as little as $3 a month into the tip jar, $5 a month to get the podcast ad-free and early, and $10 a month to hear your name in the credits and feel a smug sense of superiority. You can also buy my books from your favorite retailer or direct from my website. Thanks to everyone who contributes. Now back to me.
Now, I don't know if this was a you thing, but I saw your books tagged with Hope Punk. Was that something that you coined for that, or was that something that was kind of added to after the fact?
Hope Punk found me. I actually, the first time I was asked this question was the place I learned this term was because someone said, so what do you think about your books being called Hope Punk? And I'm like, I have no idea what that is. Please explain. But people have explained since. And I think it's wonderful, actually. I take it as a huge compliment, because to me, anytime you add the suffix punk, right, people tend to think that is an aesthetic, right? Steampunk, cyberpunk, diesel punk, you know, those conjure, you know, a certain vibe, a certain type of clothing, a look, you know. But Hope Punk, I mean, that's something a little different. And I would argue that all the other genres I just mentioned as well are best when they're actually leaning into the punk side of it, which is to say that you are resisting the status quo, which is to say that you are looking at the everyday and putting your foot down and saying, no, I think this can be different. This can be better. You know, punk implies radical thought. It implies pushing back. And there's a real sense, to me at least, of community and togetherness within punk as a concept as well. And so Hope Punk, to me, this term that has adopted my work, what it says to me is that, you know, that hope itself is an act of resistance. And that is something I truly believe. I truly believe that there is something radical and rebellious about looking at the world as it is, at looking at all the grim litany of horrors that we face every day that we have to laugh at, because what else can you do? It's a tough time to be alive, and maybe that's been true of every point in human history, but things do feel bleak a lot of the time. And so to look at that and to say, I believe the future can be better, actually. I believe that people are better than this. I believe in our inherent goodness. I believe in not like a rose-colored glasses sort of future, nothing sugar-coated, but I believe in a future in which we overcome those problems. That's not being naive, I think. That's something that takes a lot of effort and a lot of discipline to every day wake up and say, no, I think it can be better and I'm going to work toward that. That's Hope Punk to me. And so if that's a category my work is being shelved in, once again, I can't think of higher praise.
No, I absolutely love that. That's great. I came into my career right about the time, well, a ways into the time where Grimdark was the epic fantasy, like Golden Boy. Like, if you were writing a new thing in epic fantasy, it was probably Grimdark. And it's interesting because, back when I used to read a lot more, I devoured all of that. Mm-hmm. And I definitely came away with mixed feelings. Because I think even something like Grimdark at its best is about kind of about the little guy kind of getting through life regardless of how crappy it can be. Mm-hmm. But then at its worst, it's, you know, it's suffering porn, right?
Right.
Which
yes.
is, you know, like, so you kind of have a scale of these things. But I definitely, as I'm kind of getting older, I'm definitely like realizing it's really easy to despair. And us as human beings, not even consciously, but we tend to unconsciously take the easiest route for anything. And despair, I think, is one of those easy routes. You know, it's something that you can fall into really quickly without even noticing. And that you genuinely have to put some work in to kind of claw yourself out of what's essentially just a, not necessarily always, but is a mental condition. Like it's a place that you have gotten to that you have to kind of leave mentally. And it's hard to figure that stuff out.
Absolutely. No, I completely 100% agree. I think that it's a very, it's a very understandable reaction to have. And it's one I have all the time. I am not like a super rosy optimist a lot of the time, you know, especially like the inside of my head is not often a great place to be. It takes effort. It takes a minute to step back and say, wait, okay, hang on, like to really pull yourself out of that mire, you know? And that's where I think that hope as a, not as like a flavor, but as a practice is something that's really important. And for me, writing fiction is how I practice that. You know, I try to write the stories that I need to be told in that moment. The stories I write are not necessarily how I'm feeling right then. They're often usually in a response to me digging in my heels and saying, no, I'm not giving into that. But I think also, you know, none of this is to say that there is you know, like one true way of writing fiction, right? Because I think that's nonsense. Like you need to have, grimdark is good and grimdark is valid. And like, there's a reason we tell it, we have to be able to exercise our fears, our anxieties, the things we get angry about, like all of that needs to go somewhere. And that's where good art comes from, right? Like cautionary tales are important, but the thing that I took with me into my very first book and it's continued onward is, you know, I wanted to say, okay, that's good, but we need a counterpoint to that. Like that, like you can't just have that. Like you have to have futures that you're also looking forward to, because if the only story, you know, coming at it from the science fiction side of things, if the only stories we're telling about the future are scary and bleak, that even though it's in a fictional context, I mean, you know, these things are symbiotic, right? That does bleed into your real world feelings about what's the future going to be like? What do I have to look forward to? And so I think that writing in a space where you're telling more hopeful stories, more aspirational stories is just the other side of that scale. You know, I don't see them as in competition with each other. I see it as just two things in balance, you know?
Well, and I think as writers, like we have to really keep, we have to really stay conscious of the fact that the life is complicated. Like human beings are so incredibly complicated. And we kind of live in this world where it's really easy for, you know, corporations, for news outlets, for politics to all be painted in kind of these left, right, black, white, etc., you know, kind of polarized ideas. And like it's almost necessary for a global society because you have to simplify things to make a global society work. But also it kind of sucks. like the world is so incredibly complicated and we're told every day, you know, oh, it's, you know, evil, good, you know, whatever. And even in our media, you know, like you look back at, you know, something like Tolkien and you kind of come back to that very basic, you know, like the good races versus the orcs kind of thing. And you get it's really easy, I think, in fiction to fall into kind of that good versus evil, or, you know, like to do the same thing because it's a simplification that helps you reach your readership. And constantly both as a writer and as a person thinking about and remembering how complicated the world around you is on the simplest levels. I think it really, like we were saying before, it kind of helps keep you humble a little bit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And not, I don't know, kind of helps even, you know, whatever that, you know, the righteous rage in your breast, right?
Yeah.
Like all the screaming in the void can kind of come down a couple of notches when you realize that these things can be better, you know, at the worst times they can be better. At the best of times, they can definitely be worse. You know, it's always like that.
Yeah, for sure. And this is one of the things that I love so much about science fiction broadly is that it gives you this opportunity to cut through the bullshit. Do you know what I mean? Of now you have a blank slate. We're not talking about real world politics. We're not talking about like different demographics as they exist here on Earth. We're somewhere else. There's like lizard people and like big lobster dudes, and you know, we're on a spaceship, and so anything goes really. And it's fantastic. It's such a great way to be able to tell stories that do dive really deep into that nuance, that lacking nuance that you were just mentioned, you know, that where you can get into stories where there are no easy answers and things aren't fair. Things maybe don't make sense. Things are really complicated. And there's no easy solution for this. And even, you know, by the end of the book, you're not sure what the solution is because nobody knows. It's just, you know, it's a big ethical or cultural mess, whatever it might be. There's something very freeing about telling those sorts of stories within fictional worlds, you know, imaginary places, imaginary species and whatnot, because not entirely, right? Because we always carry our biases, our upbringing, our experiences, our worldview with us wherever we go that influences whatever you read. But it does put a bit of a barrier between those things. It is harder, I think, to bring preconceptions into science fiction and fantasy because you don't have any preconceptions about the lizard people or the big blue lobster guys yet. You know, you have to learn who they are and you have to understand who they are, and you're not coming in with this knee-jerk reaction to whatever hashtag they fall under. You know, it's I find it a really, I mean, and this has been true since honestly, since science fiction became a thing. You know, you see this all through, you know, original Star Trek and, you know, a lot of the novels being written at the time as well. It's a wonderful way to talk about ourselves without getting mired in the real world obstacles that often prevent us from having those messier, chewier conversations.
So I was writing my first couple of Powder Mage books right about the time when the discussion online regarding things like, it was a lot of it was talking about stuff like violence against women in Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. for instance. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this was coming out kind of right after I had turned in my first book. And I remember kind of being really struck by some part of the conversation basically saying, you are writing fantasy or science fiction. You're writing secondary worlds. The rules as you know them don't apply. Mm-hmm. You can do whatever you want within the context of your world. And interestingly, I feel like that small thing really changed kind of how I write and the way I approach world building. And it really does, like, it kind of frees you up to create more, you know, like just in terms of kind of the conversation around kind of gender kind of responsibilities in society. You know, I started writing epic fantasy with that very kind of male-centric, you kind of got your male hero with a sword, and then you've got, you know, the wilting damsel, you know, waiting for him in the castle or whatever like that. And realizing that I don't have to do that, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. honestly made it so much easier to write. Like it felt way easier.
Yeah, it's interesting what happens when all of a sudden you step back and realize that the sandbox doesn't have to be as small as you thought it was. I think those are really important moments to have as a writer, regardless of where you're coming from with it, where your biases are. We all have them, you know, and that's another thing that I think this genre lends itself really well to is the ability to step back and say, well, wait, but why? Like if we have magic, why do we have to have like patriarchal systems of government? Like, why does that have to exist? And it doesn't is the thing, you know? And so I think that too, that's a conversation that I'm really glad has been happening over the past, I would say, a couple decades now. But I think that the fiction we're getting out of it is so much more interesting and vibrant as a result. I feel like there are so many people who are realizing you don't have to be hamstrung you know, in that regard anymore. You can write what you want to write, and it's really fun to see people testing those boundaries, not just when it comes to you know, sort of demographic representation, but also when it comes to what the boundaries between genres are. There are a lot more stories nowadays where you see a lot of blending between science fiction and fantasy, between you know, subgenres that previously didn't coexist. And it's like, well, why not? I think we're living in the well, why not era of science fiction and fantasy, and I think that's a great place to be.
One of my like earliest things that I did kind of post-college that I started working on, you know, when I said in my head, oh, I want to be a serious writer now, was I had this idea, this kind of pitch for a fantasy world that was Truman Show for the rest of a gigantic science fiction galaxy.
Yeah.
and I never got super far into it. I thought about it off and on, and I wrote a bit for about a year. But there was a point at which I kind of went, nobody's going to buy this. Like, all of my writing classes had all told me you can't blend this kind of stuff. And I kind of just kind of got in my head where I just, this isn't worth it. I'm not going to do this. And it's funny because now I totally think I could do something like that. Mm-hmm. And people would probably eat it up, you know, if it was good, right? Which is always if the final product.
Right. That's always the trick, is you do have to write a good book. I know, it's the worst part of this.
I know, right? Like, it's so much easier just to say a pitch and then be done with it.
Right.
But yeah, like that kind of thing, seeing kind of how, you know, these science fiction and fantasy kind of being pulled along by the self-publishing kind of ecosystem, and then and generally just kind of like the grassroots way that people talk about things on social media and stuff like that. It does. It opens the door to be able to do lots of interesting things.
Yeah, totally. I had a very similar sort of experience when I was first writing The Long Way to a Small Green Planet, which is my first novel. And I was stuck on it. Not stuck. I was writing it, but I was really... really hesitant about it and really unsure that it was worth me seeing it through, because I kept coming back to this thing of like, this isn't real science fiction because there's no we're not saving the galaxy in this, there's no planet blowing up, there's like no like super evil space cops, you know, like it's not real science fiction, there's no MacGuffin, it's like that nobody's gonna want to read this, you know. And eventually I just got stubborn about it. I was like, well, I want to write it, so we'll see. But actually, the big thing that pulled me through was there's a book of short stories that I love to the point that I had to buy a new copy last year because my original copy was falling apart. It's called Changing Planes. It's by Ursula K. Le Guin. And it's such a difficult book to explain, no matter how many times I talk about it, because every story in there is really just this kind of proof of concept. Really, the linking idea through the whole book is that if you get bored and physically uncomfortable enough, you can start to slip between dimensions, and you can do this on purpose, and you can go visit other places, right? She recommends doing this in like airport terminals and whatnot, which I really related to because I love to like space out while I'm traveling and daydream about things. But it's just all these different planets, all these different species and cultures. And the stories don't go anywhere. And I don't mean that badly, but there isn't a plot. It really is just, let's hang out with these people for a little bit and see how they are. And I've read that book 20,000 times. And so I was like, well, I want to see more books like that. And I'm like, well, if I liked reading that, then maybe somebody will like reading this thing, which is not the same thing, but it also is by design very low-key and very like, let's just hang out with some people and explore some ideas a little bit. And so I think that's an important thing too, especially for writers who are in that same place that we were in of like, this isn't any good. Nobody's going to want to read this. It's like, well, if you like it, chances are that you are not this completely singular entity that has developed an entirely new taste in art and storytelling. If you like it, just trust in that. There's going to be somebody else who likes it too. You know, if you're captivated by this idea, some other nerd who's just like you is also going to be into this. And I think just trusting your gut on stuff like that, it's so hard to do. It's so much easier said than done. But yeah.
Well, and it really is. Like I think about this a lot. You know, I had Travis Baldry on. We were just chatting last week to do a recording, and I was talking to him about cozy fantasy. Because my brain, like as a writer, I'm a decade into my career. I feel like I have cemented into this continually escalating stakes, world ending, big sort of epic fantasy, giant set pieces, big battles, lots of murder and death kind of thing. I feel like I have I'm like set in concrete in that. And I've reached a point at which I don't want to be anymore, but I also struggle pulling out of that. I struggle looking at a smaller like plot and trying to make it work, you know, kind of in accordance with these rules that are in my head that have just been kind of, you know, they've been there long enough that they think that they're the right thing to do. Right.
Right. Right.
And it's weird to be at that place in your career, like to say, you know, I love what I do and I'm going to keep doing it. But also I would like to dabble in things that are a little different and a little bit weirder. But I almost don't have to, I almost don't know how.
Right.
And I kind of struggle with trying to rebuild that part of my creative brain.
I mean, it's tricky, right? Because I'm also roughly a decade in. So we're here at a similar plateau. I think that it's tricky, right? Because you've spent all this time building that muscle, right? And you're good at that muscle that like it's almost like I don't know, a professional athlete learning a new sport. Like just because you are good at, you know, baseball or whatever it is doesn't mean that it's going to be any that's going to be super easy to pick up cricket, you know, like it looks like maybe it's kind of similar, but it's not. So you know, I think that that's I understand that. I think all of us worry about getting stuck, right? That you worry about oh God, am I just going to keep writing the same thing over and over? Even though you've never done that, but that's a fear of mine all the time of like, oh God, what if I run out of ideas and like, you know, I'm just sort of rehashing, you know, things I've done before, which is like, there's no evidence that I would do that, but that's how it feels, right? You're so used to this territory by now that it does get hard to branch out, to try new things. It's tricky. Yeah. If you find a great solution for it, let me know. Because yeah.
And likewise.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I feel like my brain goes to that more and more these days of okay, I want to do something slightly different. Mm-hmm. And it's weird. And for any, you know, any actual fans listening, that doesn't mean I'm going to stop writing epic fantasy. Like, I love what I write and it's so much fun to do. But like, you do have to change things up. I mean, there's some authors who are very happy writing the same exact book again and again until they die. And you know what? I actually have a deep respect for that.
Seriously, like, me too. Like, I don't mean that badly at all when I say I don't want to do that. Like, if you found your groove and that's where you live, awesome. Like, that's amazing.
Right. And you clear, like, some of these people become masters of a single book.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And like, gosh, like when I was a teenager, I got into reading, my dad and I both read the Clive Cussler novels together. And every single novel is the exact same thing. It, like, literally, they just file off the serial numbers, put a new one out, and that's it. And, you know, that was fun. And my dad enjoyed them. And we always talked about, oh, did this twist. We definitely saw it coming, but, you know, it was still cool. Like, it just, sometimes authors just are really good at the one thing. And it can make them a whole career. It can make them genuinely fabulously wealthy.
I think that's also actually a really important thing to remember, right? Like, everything you just said about those books, like, coming at it as a reader and not a writer, you didn't care at all that it had the serial numbers filed off. You had a great time with it. Like, that's like people listening can't see this, but he's got the biggest smile right now talking about these books. You know, we, from a writing standpoint, you get so caught up in, this has to be the most creative, original thing ever. I have to reinvent the wheel every single time. And I think that readers, and I'm speaking as a reader here myself too, are more forgiving. Sometimes it's actually really satisfying when you can see the twist coming. If it's really cool, if you're like, oh, I see what they're going to do. And then it's like, ah, they did it. Yes. And it can be really satisfying. So I think, Maybe the grand lesson here is cut ourselves some slack a little bit.
Well, I don't know if you've found this, but I have found that, like, the opposite of what you were saying with readers is that the writer brain, like, I can become incredibly arrogant without even noticing. Like, I can have kind of that weird response of, you know, just waving off an entire genre of book because I'm like, ah, it's not really, you know, that's just such and such, you know, like, I think that writers do that. I think that we kind of will get set in the what we were taught, you know, how we grew up learning about writing. You know, like when I was in college, there were professors that did that about science fiction and fantasy.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just absolutely dismissive. And, you know, I had one professor very unironically tell me, oh, I suppose you could make money doing that if you want.
Oh, gross.
And you're just like, but wait, I want it to be both, you know, fulfilling and a career. Can I do both? Is that okay? Like, and I don't know. It is weird how you can kind of reach that point. And you get that a bit in kind of the, you know, like the kind of the backbiting online clicks.
Yes.
Where you'll have, you know, the authors who are always winning awards. You know, they're like, ah, they maybe kind of think a little down on the authors that aren't ever in the awards sections. Mm-hmm. And the opposite, too. Oh, that's just an award book. Yeah. You know, like, it's weird how we kind of get it stuck in these ruts.
Yeah, I totally know what you mean about it getting clicky. This is why one of my favorite types of events to do, like, I love doing science fiction fantasy conventions, obviously. It's my people. I dig it. I love doing literary festivals where you get people from lots of different genres. Those, I think it was actually really, really valuable for me to do some of those, like, early in my career, because I was just so embedded in this genre, this community, everything. And so getting to chat with, you know, have drinks with, be on a panel with people who write romance, who write mystery, who write other things, just learning how the sausage gets made elsewhere, learning about the work that goes into it. You know, I think that's so important. It's so important. And, you know, I remember one of the best conversations I've had was actually just like in the shuttle bus going from the hotel that the festival had put us up to the festival itself. And the lady I was sitting next to, you know, she had a badge as well. And so I asked her, you know, oh, so, you know, what do you write? And she wrote early reader books, like the, you know, like the cardboard, like flip books for little kids. And I was like, wow, okay, yeah. What's that like? And she started talking, you know, because at first she was kind of self-deprecating about it, you know, just kind of like, oh, well, you know. And I was like, no, not like, tell me what it's like to write these books. And once she actually got into it, I had so much respect for what goes into a little cardboard book, because she had to think so hard about, like, not just what words a 3 or 4 year old would know, but what sort of concepts, what's going to be overwhelming for them, what's not, like, how do you get an idea, like, really, really clearly across to somebody who sees the world very literally and doesn't have the full framework yet. And I was like, that's an incredible skill to be able to do that. I don't think I could do that, you know, like, and so I think there's a lot of value in you know, if your goal is to break out of those cliques, to not get stuck in those ruts, to talk to people who write different stuff, you learn really great things, and then you will never look at a little cardboard flip book the same way again.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've been to a couple of festivals. I think the only one I've done a bunch of times is Tucson Festival of Books. And that one, like, a very similar experience where you're suddenly thrown from, I normally go to science fiction and fantasy conventions, mm-hmm. and you get an idea of what those are like, the type of people, the conversations you're going to have, all that. And then you go to Tucson Festival of Books, where science fiction and fantasy is like, you know, 5 of the invited authors.
Yeah.
And you walk into the luncheon
at
the very beginning.
Yes.
And you're suddenly talking to someone who's a poet, you know, you're like talking to someone who writes, you know, military nonfiction, mm-hmm. you know, like you have a conversation for 30 minutes with someone, no idea who they are. And then when they leave, you finally like get out your phone and quickly Google them. And you're like, oh, they're like a luminary in the field of such and such. And it's such a weird experience to like be thrown into this very like, you know, like this blender of all these writers.
Yeah, I, you know, many times I've had the experience that I just described where, you know, I sort of get into the melange of genres, and I really love those experiences. But sometimes when you said, you know, you go in there and you go to the luncheon, on occasion, like, I've definitely ended up at the little corner table of sci-fi writers, because we all kind of flock together and are like, hey, what's up? This is weird. So, you know, I think sometimes there's safety in numbers as well. But it's awesome to I think that the big lesson I've taken away from stuff like that is, you know, instead of looking at things and being like, ugh, that's just such and such, or, you know, blah, it's just like, that's not for me. You know, that's whatever that is, it's not for me. I respect the work that goes into it, but it's not for me. And I think that that has, for me at least, I just been so much of a healthier way of looking at it. Because I also, you know, that's how people look at my work too. My work's not for everybody. And I'll be the first person to tell folks that, you know? And so I think if you just sort of view it as the great big ecosystem, you know, the big pond that we're all swimming around in, it also lends itself well to what we were talking about earlier, about feeling more comfortable, about pushing those boundaries, breaking some of those rules. If you look at how other people are doing it, it's exciting to be like, well, why couldn't I take that thing and do it over here? Why not? You know?
Yeah, for sure. Well, and it's interesting because you get that kind of coming the opposite direction from the readers when you meet someone random and you tell them what you do for a living, and they become very apologetic that they don't read, you know, science fiction or fantasy.
Yeah,
and it's so funny because I'm always like, just, you know, smile, nod, get through it. But in my head, I'm always thinking, man, it's okay.
Yeah, like, there's so many books. It's okay.
Right. It's totally fine if you don't read that genre. It's fine if you don't read at all. That's okay. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not going to think of you as a lesser human being. And it is funny that people will, when they find out that you do a creative thing for a living, there does seem to be like an instinctual, like they want to connect with that immediately, or they want to try to give you their reasons that they don't connect with.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's a funny thing that happens. I feel like folks outside of this industry don't really know what to do with it when you're like, oh, here's what I do. I remember there. So whenever I fly out of the San Francisco airport, SFO, there's a bookstore there, and a bookseller came to one of my events years ago and said, you know, if you ever come through Terminal 3, come by the bookstore and sign what we have in stock. And I was like, okay. So I've just done that ever since. And this one time I was in there signing books, and this lady, you know, just some fellow traveler, was just looking at me really weird. Like, you know, because I'm just sitting there writing in books. And I think she was looking at me like, do I need to call the cops or whatever? But she comes over and she's like, did you write these books? And I was like, yeah, I wrote these books. And she just kind of just stared at it for just at the stack of books for a minute and at me. And she's like, so that's all you do all day is just write and write. And I was like, That's pretty much it. Yeah. it was just kind of this funny moment of being there for someone's brief existential crisis of realizing that people write books, I guess.
I almost hesitate to admit this, but I think that one of my favorite tiny pleasures of being a professional author is that moment when you tell a stranger what you do for a living and they give you a small double take, like, because this is, it's probably 70% of the people that I meet and end up talking to and tell them what I do for a living. They kind of give you a little, wait, what? You actually do that? Mm-hmm. Like there is a person on the other end of the books I read kind of thing.
Yes.
You know, because we live in an ecosystem, you know, science fiction and fantasy conventions, where we meet people that are very aware of their favorite authors and things like that. But the vast majority of the kind of public, they don't give a second thought to the director of their favorite TV show or the writer of their favorite books. They just consume the new thing that comes out. And that's very normal. It's very human.
Yes.
But it's, I don't know why, but I absolutely love that moment when they kind of go, oh, you make things, like imaginary things. That's kind of me. Like, and it happens, and it's like a split second thing, and you just kind of have to watch for it. But I love it every single time.
Do you get the question of the sort of weird job interview thing that happens when you say, oh, I'm a writer, and say, what do you write? And I say science fiction, and they're like, oh, are you published? That's the first one I get. And I say, yes, I'm published. And they say, what's the name of your book? And I'm like, well, I've written several books. And then they go, oh, you're a real writer. And there's so many things to unpack in that. Cause it's like, first of all, anybody who writes is a real writer. And we really need to get past this idea of you have to be published in order for it to count. But it's also just funny seeing that, like, people don't really know what to ask in that moment. Cause, you know, for other jobs, you can say, oh, where do you work? You know, what's your salary? Blah, blah, blah. Like, what's your salary would be really rude. But people do ask, like, how many books have you sold? And I'm like, I'm not telling you that. Like, that's a really weird question to ask. But they just don't know. They don't know how to follow it. And so that's the, are you published in a sort of, like, let me check your ID at the door before we have this conversation. It's always really weird.
Yeah. I always phrase that in the terms of, you get that moment in their eyes where they're trying to decide if you live in your mom's basement or if you're a multimillionaire.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
It's like George R. R. Martin or the guy next door that smells really weird. Like, which are you? And they're trying to kind of get a scope for that.
Yeah. I had a cab driver once who asked me what I did, and I told him. He said, do you make any money doing that? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, well, it's really nice to get, like, paid for your hobbies. And I was like, okay. Like, this conversation's over now. Yeah, people get funny. But what we do is weird, and I fully embrace that.
Yeah. Oh, dude.
I like having a weird job.
Well, mm-hmm. It is weird. And you're not taught about what a creative career looks like when you're in school.
No.
You get an idea of what an office job looks like. You know, if you go to a trade school, you understand working with your hands. Like, you kind of get a structure, and, you know, both from your own education, but also from media, right? Like watching TV and stuff like that. And, you know, kind of creative professionals are one of those kind of vague things where you don't really get a good structure. You know, when a writer is on TV, they tend to be, you know, like it's the Seinfeld thing. You know, you've got, you know, Jerry Seinfeld, you know, multimillionaire, you know, comedian, and oh, it's the sitcom about this guy's life.
Yeah.
And you don't, but you don't actually get like an idea of what like a real human being is like.
No, none of those people, like none of those characters ever have to file quarterly taxes.
Right?
None of them have to explain to like someone at the bank when you're trying to get a mortgage, like what a book advance is and why it's not a salary, you know, like nothing is set up. For creative work, for gig work, for anything that falls outside of the 9 to 5. And so I get it. I get why people kind of, you know, record scratch when we talk about what we do, or when we try to, like, I don't know, fill out a form for literally anything. It's impossible. But I like it. I like this weird niche that I have come to occupy.
Yeah, well, and the financial thing is a weird place because we get paid in very weird ways.
Yes.
Like I remember the very beginning of my career, like I had to hold over credit card debt, the most I ever have in my life, like $6,000 or $7,000 of credit card debt, because I knew I was getting paid $40,000 in a month. Mm-hmm. Like there's, you can't explain to people that are used to getting paid every 2 weeks,
yeah,
what it is to try to financially plan around royalties,
right?
You know, stuff like that.
Yeah, you can't is the thing. Like, you can plan around, you know I will get paid at these times of year, but there will be other things that pop up that are surprises, and I don't know what those things are going to be. I know what I'm going to get when, you know, I deliver something advance-wise, but like otherwise it's just a crapshoot. You know,
yeah.
And I feel like for people just starting out, for like, you know, aspiring writers, like new writers, like younger folks, I feel like that's a part of the conversation that is really missing and really needs to happen, of like, listen, you can totally do this as a job, but like, you need to plan for it. You need to know what this is going to entail, because it is not like, you know, you get your 6-figure book deal and then you just kick up your heels. That's not how it works at all. It is tricky, and there's a lot of uncertainty that goes along with it. And, you know, tying it into what you were saying earlier about, you know, worrying about, can I do something new? Have I gotten stuck in this rut? It's hard, right? Because that is intrinsically tied to your financial well-being. Like, you have this need as a creator to try new stuff, to make something new, to keep building, you know, on top of the skills you've already made. That's what artists do. That's what drives us. But at the same time, we live in a capitalist society and have to eat. So, you know, you do have to think about, okay, is this like bold new creative vision that I have spent years agonizing over, is it going to sell? And it's a tough equation, and it's definitely what keeps me awake at night. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. When your rut is what's paying the bills, it's even harder to get out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I like to finish up the episode each week by asking everybody the same question. Very left field question. And this is, what's the last thing that you ate that blew your mind? The
last thing that I ate that blew my mind. Wow, okay. The last thing that I ate that blew my mind was, I was in Sonoma a few weeks ago. I did an event in San Francisco, and on the way back, my wife and I stopped in Sonoma for a couple of days just to chill and eat good food. And I had this duck for dinner that was like fall apart, like tender, like it was just perfectly cooked. I could have eaten it forever. I talked very little through the meal. I do not think I was the best company, because I was just so enraptured with this incredibly prepared duck. And now
I really adore hungry. Duck.
That's so good.
It's so good.
Mm-hmm.
It's it is like my rule now is that if duck is on the menu, I'm going to get it.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
Like I think I only had it for the first time maybe about 6 years ago, mm-hmm. and I probably have only had it. Like, we don't eat duck a lot in the U.S.
No,
and so like I think I've probably only had duck a dozen times in my life now. Mm-hmm. But man, like whenever I'm in Europe, yeah, I'm gonna be in Poland in about a month, and I'm like I will be watching menus for duck because it's just so much more common in Europe.
Yeah, I come from an international family, and I have a lot of family in Europe, and my wife is European as well. And I was talking to a friend from New York a few months ago, and she mentioned she'd never had duck. I was like, really? You've never had duck? She's like, well, in Chinese food and stuff, but I don't think I've ever had roast duck. And I'm like, I've had duck a lot. And she's like, I'm interested about the context in which you've had duck, because she was thinking there'd be some cool cultural story behind it. But I was like, well, sometimes I go to a restaurant and I'll be like, oh, they have duck on the menu. And then I order the duck.
Right.
Like, yeah, it was a
pretty simple,
completely uninteresting story. She was very disappointed. But now I've shared it on a podcast as well. So.
That was science fiction author Becky Chambers. Thanks again to Becky for coming on to chat. You can find links to her website down in the show notes. You can find me, as always, at brianmcclellan.com. Special thanks to James Sutter for music and Tom Bishop for production. If you'd like to support the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/pagebreak or buy my books in ebook, paperback, or audio. You can also get signed copies of my books direct from my website or swag from my Redbubble store. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review. If you're listening to this via Patreon, please stick around for a bonus chat during the epilogue. Special thanks to Elijah, Ivor Gullickson, James Clark, Jennifer Johnson, Jason Nall, Kyle Anderson, Sexton Hardcastle, Talon, Brian, Will Lebelski, Bradley Thornhill, and Roberto Fontada for their backing on Patreon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.